Good afternoon, brethren. It is wonderful to be here. I remember the first time I was at a Salem convention. It was a wonderful blessing. You know, there are a few. It is their first, and I know it'll be a wonderful blessing. Our title is In the Wilderness, and before we begin, we'd like to bring the love of the Muhammad class, especially Sister Karen. Sister Karen Wildblood, also we had a wonderful time with the Rosses and the brethren in Sacramento this past week. We have a nice fellowship at Sister Joy's home and the Garrisons, and especially Brother Jim McClugan wanted to send his love. Well, our title is In the Wilderness. And a lot of our comments, sort of the prelude of what, in fact, I trust, does everybody have a copy of the handout? Oh, well, okay. Well, you'll be getting a handout very soon.
Don't worry about that.
He's got it covered. But in case you get the handout a little later than we go over it, if you look at reprint 54 called The Antichrist, or if you look at reprint 304 also called The Antichrist, you'll get most of the prelude that we're going to talk about. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to go on the assumption that you've had a chance to review these things. And then we're going to finish up with Revelation chapter 7. But in between 12 and 17, we're going to talk about quite a bit of history. And we want to we want to, in our minds, go back in time and find out what the history was really like, what life was like for Israel and for the church in the darkest part of the gospel age. Well, in the wilderness is a term that's used to express the condition of the church during the age of sacrifice. But what we want to focus on is this deep, deep, dark, dark wilderness during the majority of the gospel age. This symbol of in the wilderness is given to us in Revelation chapter 12, which we're going to briefly go over. That's what this handout is for. We're going to go at a rapid pace because we think most are familiar with these things, but you can refer back to that with the handout. In Revelation 12:1, there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. Well, this appearing in heaven was a picture of spiritual control or ecclesiastical control. This woman was the early church, clothed with the light of the gospel, or we could say the grace covenant, the Sarah feature of the Abrahamic covenant, with the heritage of the law covenant as her support, on her head a gold crown of 12 stars, the teaching of the apostles. In Revelation 12:2, and she being with child, cried, travailing in birth, in pain to be delivered. Now, she being with child, for the sisters who have children, you know that you are one person, the child within you is another. And you want to keep that in mind. So this true church was shown as being with child. This thing was growing and developing within the true church. And it's because many in the early church, they wanted relief from the bitter persecutions. This was during the Smyrna age of the church, stage of the church, especially under Diocletian. They desired to get away from these bitter persecutions and see if they could have a more congenial relationship with the empire, union with the empire. And this was really the very beginnings of the system of a state-dominated Christianity with an early head, Constantine. Constantine was really a Christianized pagan emperor who retained the position of Pontifex Maximus, Pontifex Maximus meaning the chief religious ruler. So on to verse 3, and there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads. This great red dragon was pagan Rome, the civil power, in its successive and distinct forms of government. In the fourth verse, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, to devour her child as soon as it was born. Well, this shows that the political pressures of the civil power, this Roman dragon, really wanted to have control of this new ecclesiastical entity, this church, this Christian, so-called Christian church that was being developed. And what she did is used influence and caused some of the church teachers or stars to be degraded from their proper teachings. And now they're teaching more worldly ideas. They're being cast to earth. In verse 5, and she brought forth a man-child who was able to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. Well, this man-child, this was the beginnings of what would become papacy. Now note, the man-child is different from the woman. It came out of the woman. It's separate from the woman. The man-child is what would become papacy, a church united with the world, with a man as its head. Initially, Constantine was this Pontifex Maximus, but we know later, in later centuries, eventually the Bishop of Rome or Pope was recognized as the chief religious ruler. Well, this man-child would gradually take the place of God in authority over the Christian world and over the Word of God itself. So, what can the woman do? Well, in Revelation 12:6, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And I think we're all familiar with the 1,260 years that this represents. Well, the woman, the true church, fled from this worldly dominated false Christianity into the wilderness, really a picture of disrespect, being outcast from the world, and God would feed her for 1,260 years. This is really from 539 to 1799. And here's where we want to denote that the city was Babylon. Now, what is the city the true church is looking for? Well, it's the New Jerusalem. This is the city with foundation. So the true church doesn't want to be part of that city, Babylon. So if you're not in the city, you're in the wilderness. And that's the whole idea of wilderness. And if you're really going to see the city for what it is, you've got to get out of it. You've got to be in the wilderness. And if you're in the wilderness, now you can see the harlot. You can see Babylon. You can see. But once you get, you know, get perspective, once you get the perspective, and that's what we want to see here. So the true church was a chaste virgin waiting for the New Jerusalem. They don't want to be part of this city, Babylon. So she flees into the wilderness, a condition of fidelity to the Lord, apart from the influence of the apostate church, but under its jurisdiction and dominion. And we're going to see more about that later. Seventh verse, and there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought his angels. Now, this can be easily misunderstood. Michael means who as God. But what was happening is the Pope was putting himself in the place of God. He was saying, I'm the one who as God. Well, this war in heaven, we know what happened, is eventually the papacy got the upper hand over the pagan Rome, got the upper hand over the civil power. The Pope gains power over the kings of the Holy Roman Empire and the emperor. And just note in 2 Thessalonians 2:4, when it said that, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. This is the man of sin. In the eighth verse, and talking about this, the dragon prevailed not, neither was a place found any more in heaven. And in the ninth verse, the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. And he was cast out into the earth, society, and his angels were cast out with him. Well, this shows that the pagan Roman Empire, the civil power dragon, was cast out of authority. But this was really in name only, because when you look at what happened, paganism really overcame Christianity. That's really what happened. Even though this was papacy had control, it was now a paganized false Christianity. In the 10th verse, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them day and night. Well, papacy claimed that it was the power of God and Christ that had gotten this victory to bless the world through them. And of course, the heyday of the Catholic Church is what the rest of the world now calls the Dark Ages. But they're saying that's because they were such great representatives of God. In the 11th verse, and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto death. This is really papacy claimed that their victory was because of their own sacrificing spirit and the support of Christ and the word of God. These were the claims that they were making. Therefore, rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows he has but a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. So this woman, the true church, the one that fled into the wilderness, one trying to maintain her fidelity to God, was being used by papacy to persecute the true church, those who were now called heretics. The heretics and pagans, former pagans, would be persecuted by papacy through the civil power which she now controlled. And in the 14th verse, last verse we're going to talk about here, and to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into a place where she is nourished for a time, times, and a half a time, from the face of the serpent. The woman, again, is the true church in the wilderness, was given the strength of the two wings, the scriptures, the Old and the New Testaments, to the extent that they were revealed at that time. Now, she may not have had all the truth, but she certainly knew where the errors were. She knew where the majority of the errors were, and the true church didn't want to have anything to do with them in this exiled wilderness condition. She remained in this wilderness until the power to persecute was broken in 1799 and after. We're going to modify that statement a little bit later as we close. But what we want to concentrate is this 1,260 years of this very highly persecuted wilderness condition. We know that during this time, the kings of the earth were drunken with papacy's lies and claims. In Revelation 17:2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. In Revelation 18:3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants have waxed rich, etc. Hopefully this is a review of things that we've studied many times in the past. And if you haven't studied the Revelation chapter 12 specifically, think of the man of sin chapter. You know, things are brought out very clearly there. But what we'd like to do is now look at the status of religion itself on planet Earth and the way things were, the dynamics. We'd like to go back before Christianity, before the Gospel Age, and look at the status of religion, both true and false. And I think it's going to give us some insights into what this wilderness condition really was. Looking at the true religion given by the one true God, we know that God had manifested himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He had led the sons of Israel, the sons of Jacob, out of Egyptian bondage through his work with Moses, and established a covenant with Israel, with the sons of Jacob. Well, this was to be a theocracy, and there's something special about a theocracy. All of the laws came from God himself. In fact, Israel was not authorized to enact any law themselves. They didn't have a Congress where they could say, oh, let's make up a law. They all came from God. So they were supposed to understand, interpret, now enforce, and live the laws of God. This was Israel's responsibility to actually live these laws. Now, when we look at the false religions during this Jewish age, the Gentile kingdoms and empires were governed by human laws, for better or for worse. They were what they were. But virtually all of these kingdoms, they wanted the sanction of some god. They want something to say, here's where we're getting the authority to do these things we're doing. Or to claim that some god was guiding them, was directing them, was blessing their king or blessing their emperor. Some even went to the extreme to claim that their king, their Caesar, their emperor, or their pharaoh was actually God. Now, that's kind of a hard one for me to swallow. But at least to say this emperor is Pontifex Maximus, he's being guided and directed by God himself, whether it's one god or a bunch of gods, it doesn't matter. this emperor has this authority because he's the one chosen by God to be in this position. These claims, if believed, would help these emperors to rule with absolute power and eliminate any attempt to threaten the emperor, his authority, or the empire. And that's what they wanted, absolute, total control. And having the emperor and the religion all together inseparable is the way this was achieved. Well, any challenge to the emperor was considered treasonous, and that makes sense. He's the civil authority. This would be treason. The treason could come either from questioning the civil or the religious authority of the emperor, because the emperor was Pontifex Maximus. He was the chief religious ruler. So the civil, the religious, they were all seen as one. They were inseparable in the minds of the people. Totally intertwined. Now here's an example of this. We're all familiar with this. The three Hebrews in Daniel chapter 3. The three Hebrews, the golden image, the fiery furnace. In Daniel 3 verse 5, it says, when you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, dulcimer, etc., all kinds of music, you should fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And whosoever falleth not down will be cast into the fiery furnace, this burning fiery furnace. So I think you get the idea. This was obligatory. And here's a quote from reprint 4874. Brother Russell mentions that all would be expected to fall down and worship and reverence the image which represented Nebuchadnezzar in that it represented his God. So maybe it represented Nebuchadnezzar, I don't know. Maybe it represented his God, that's fine. But if you worship that God, you're showing your support for the God who's supporting, directing, and guiding Nebuchadnezzar. So you are showing support for the empire, and that's the whole point. Not to do so would show disloyalty, ingratitude, and treason. End of quote from that reprint. Now note, the three Hebrews, what were they doing? You know, they refused to fall down and worship. They were making a decision on their part that showed their preference or choice in religious worship. They said, we're going to make a decision. We've thought this through. We've made the decision. We can't do this. But the expression of their choice was seen as a treacherous, traitorous, treasonous act which challenged the authority and power of the emperor and the empire. It wasn't because of the religious thing they were doing. It's because they saw this as you're challenging the authority of the emperor and the empire. Not permissible. They were not allowed to have any choices in religion. This was made clear by the penalty of the furnace. There are no options here. But note very carefully, they never challenged his civil authority. They obeyed all his laws. In fact, they were ministers. They're actually obeying and enforcing his laws. They're showing, we agree with the civil authority. Actually, God had overruled this. We know that. We're not challenging civil authority. It's the religious part. Well, this was a total paradigm shift, and they were starting to live the paradigm shift that Jesus had talked about. Jesus had said in Matthew 22:21, even though the rest of the world saw religion and civil authority is inextricably intertwined, they are the same thing. There's no way to separate them in the minds of the entire rest of the world. Jesus says, Matthew 22:21, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. My word, what has Jesus just done? He's taken this intertwining of civil and religious, and he has now ripped them apart in the minds of his followers. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's. This was incomprehensible to the rest of the world. Totally incomprehensible. Back to Nebuchadnezzar. Well, Nebuchadnezzar and everyone else in the empire, they made no distinction between the two. They could not separate them. They were the same because they're in the same person. Huh? I mean, you're not going to cut Nebuchadnezzar in half. He was Pontifex Maximus, and this was acknowledged by all the people. Well, later, you know, the three go in the fiery furnace, and what happens? Well, later he says, well, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire. The fourth is like the Son of God. And then he decrees, so they come out You know, cords are burned, not even the smell of smoke, etc. And then Nebuchadnezzar has an aha moment, and he says, Daniel 3:29, "For every people, nation, and language which speak anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they shall be cut in pieces, houses made of dunghill, etc., etc., etc." So he's saying, okay, your God, he's fine with me. So he sees this tremendous reality right before his eyes in the threat of this terrible punishment of being burned alive. They come right out of the furnace. Now, note that Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged this, but that didn't motivate him to become a Jew. He didn't become a Jew. He simply indicated official tolerance for Jews. So the Jews were now exempted from this forced uniformity of religion throughout the empire. That's the main point. They essentially had a waiver. Anybody other than a Jew, you must have the religion of the empire. When you obey that religion, you're showing support for the emperor. There's no other way. If you want to do something else, you're dead. We kill you. Nebuchadnezzar just proven that. And this continues. Well, let's go back to the law at Mount Sinai. Let's go back to the true religion. See how that was structured. If we go back to the law in Mount Sinai, Exodus 19 and 20, both chapters 19 and 20, Exodus 20, verse 3, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." So God wanted Israel also to have religious uniformity. You will have no other gods. You have other gods, you'll be stoned. That was shown to them many times. Golden image they set up. 3,000 were killed. Balaam and Balak, they start worshiping the Moabite gods. 23,000 are killed. They're shown, you will have no other gods before me. Absolute religious uniformity. But this was the true religion. It was for Israel's own good, not simply so God could maintain control. God's not worried about that. Because God was preparing Israel for their future. He had told Moses to say to them, this is in Exodus 4:22, "Israel is my son, even my firstborn. Tell Pharaoh if he won't let Israel go, I will slay his son, even his firstborn." Well, what is God really saying when he says that, "Israel's my firstborn"? When a father says, "You're my firstborn, you're my heir," that means this is the one who God is going to give the greatest inheritance he can possibly give. It goes to the firstborn. And what is the greatest inheritance that God can possibly give to anyone? That's to be the body of Christ. He's prepared them centuries, about 1,600 years before the opportunity is really before them. He's preparing them as a people to become the bride of Christ. And typically, they were to, in Exodus 19:6, they were to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. They were to all understand the law and do the law. This would prepare them for the reality of 1 Peter 2:9, where they would be a royal priest, a holy nation, a peculiar people. That's where Israel was meant to go. So he wanted religious uniformity. No other gods. You have another god, you're not going to get it. You're not going to be prepared. Well, at Jesus' first advent, they were all supposed to transfer from Moses to Christ. They were all supposed to have this preparation. In John 1:11 and 12, John says, John in his gospel says, "He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God." So this religious uniformity for the Jews was a wonderful thing to prepare them for the greatest thing that God had for them. And this is where their true religion was taking them, to see Christ, to transfer from Moses to Christ. It had been shown in all the prophets, as Jesus explained on the road to Emmaus. He explained to the disappointed ones on the road to Emmaus, here's what all the prophets were saying. That's where we've been going. We've been going to this point. Christ must suffer and die, and this is an opportunity for you to come into Christ. But most of natural Israel could not make the journey. They could not conceptualize. They could not see where it was leading. They could not see Christ Jesus for who he was. They thought that Jesus and his followers, what they were doing was blasphemy against the one true God, and they also thought that it was a threat to their authority and to this monolithic society, this theocracy of church-state all rolled into one. It was the correct theocracy, but when this transfer came, they were supposed to see it and take opportunity. Well, after Jesus' ascension and Pentecost, things changed for those following this new, true path. Things changed. The Jewish Christians, they went from being the majority religion in Judea and Galilee to being the persecuted minority religion wherever they went. Again, going from being the majority religion, in fact, it's supposed to be the only religion initially, but now they find they're going to be the persecuted minority. That's a huge shift. But they were prepared for this. They were told, "Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake." Matthew 10:25, "If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of his household?" So expect this. You're going to be the minority. Nobody's going to understand what you're doing. John 16:2, "They shall put you out of the synagogues. Yea, the time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God's service." And what was their attitude about this supposed to be? Well, fight back. You know, no, not at all. Jesus had told them. He says, "But I say unto you," in Matthew 5:44, "But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you." They were told, you will be the persecuted minority. No one will understand. In fact, they will think they are doing God's service when they kill you and you turn around and you bless the ones who are doing that. He was saying, here's what true Christianity is. The followers of Christ would be the misunderstood, persecuted minority, both among the Jews and the Gentiles, who both required religious uniformity. Both of them did. But this was one of the main ways that God would develop, test, and prove the true church. And prove to the true church how much the truth actually meant to them. And I think we all know that. When you have an opportunity to suffer righteousness' sake, and you say, "I made it through that, I'm glad." And you realize, now I know how much the truth means to me. I know how much it means to me because I was able to undergo that. Thank you. So we don't necessarily have to prove it to God all the time. We have to prove it to ourselves and establish that track record. This is our standard performance. And pretty soon nothing that the Lord would ever permit will derail us. That's what he's teaching us. And the true church understood this. They've been told these lessons. They understood this. Well, in pagan Rome, the emperor was Pontifex Maximus. He insisted that his subjects worship the entire pantheon of gods who guided and blessed the emperor. Now, the pantheon, I did a little research on this. I didn't know what it was. There's like this little house, or this big stone house. I guess that's where their gods live. And you had a smorgasbord of gods. Here are just some of them. Jupiter, Juno, Mars, Venus, Minerva, Neptune, Ceres, Diana, Bacchus, Mercury, Vesta. It goes on a little farther. So you got Mars, the god of war. You're going to go off to battle. You may want to worship the god of war. How about Venus, god of beauty? Maybe she's what you're into. Minerva, god of wisdom. Bacchus, the god of wine, the god of happy hour. Is that what you want to worship? Well, there was something for everybody. But the thing was, you weren't allowed to make up your own god. Because the gods of the pantheon were the ones that were guiding and directing the emperor. And when you worship any one of these, or all of them, didn't matter, you were showing that you supported the emperor. And that was the whole point. Uniformity. We'll diversify, have a bunch of, you know, gods to pick from, but you can't pick anything else. This is why the Apostle Paul was actually brought up on charges, because they said, "Oh, you have this new religion." New religion was punishable by death. And he was trying to say, no, this is where the Judaism was supposed to go. This is Judaism. They just got off the bus. You know, they couldn't make the journey. The Jews couldn't. But this is how every citizen shows support for the emperor as Pontifex Maximus and as the absolute autocrat by divine authority. Now note how often this was shown. It was shown daily. Well, how did they do this? Well, the subjects of the Roman Empire could, for a fee, you know, if they had some meat, you didn't just, you know, cook it and eat it yourself. You took it to the priest, you paid him a little fee, he would do this bippity-boppity-boo, sacrifice it, you know, maybe take a little chip of it, whatever, sacrifice it to the idol, and then you get it back. Oh, you get it back. And then what you do is you eat it, and you automatically get the blessing of whatever god it's been sacrificed to. Now, in doing this, you have financial support for the priests, for their religion, and you're showing support for the empire. And that's the important part. You are when you eat the meat sacrificed to idols, you are showing support for the empire. It's an endorsement of the Roman Empire, their emperor, the empire, the society, and their very way of life. So, now notice, after the mysterious sacrifice, the meat was returned. The blessing of those gods was automatically received. You eat it, you automatically get it. Now, this was merely a procedure. It was a procedure. It's things you go through the motions. In fact, it was this mysterious thing called the mysterion in Greek. We're going to come back to that, the mysterion. You pay your money, you eat the meat, you get the blessing, and you're politically correct. And this is for everyone. And if it's going to be for everybody, it better be down to the level of the lowest common denominator, because the common man, I mean, it doesn't matter, smart, dumb, it doesn't matter. If it's for everybody, you don't want them to have to think about it. You just have them do it. That's it. You just have them do it. There was no need for faith, for piety, for righteousness to receive this blessing. In fact, many people would take the meat, as I said, have a party, have an orgy, doesn't matter, they're automatically blessed. And just about all the meat sold at market had already been sacrificed to idols. It's already been done this. Because they want to make sure whether you're rich enough to have the meat yourself or you're just buying a, you know, I don't know, sandwiches weren't invented yet. You're buying some piece of meat. They wanted you to know it's already been sacrificed to idols. So wherever you get your food, you have the opportunity to show support for the emperor. And how often do you eat, brethren? Usually every day. So they wanted this support to be in your mind for the emperor, the empire, and whatever these gods are every day. That's the whole point. In fact, this is how the early church was actually revealed to others by their refusal to eat the meat sacrificed to idols. Paul talks about this in in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Acts 21, 25, and in the first council of the church in Acts 15, verse 29. Well, going to Acts 21, 25, he says they should keep themselves from things offered to idols. Well, in the minds of Christians, this was a religious decision. They weren't questioning the authority of the emperor. It was a religious choice, a religious decision. But in the minds of the Romans, this was open rebellion against the Roman Empire, the emperor, and their very way of life. Refusing to eat the meat sacrificed to idols, this was an indicator of treason. Well, Christians have had a very tough time in the first two stages of the church, both Ephesus and Smyrna in these first two churches. During Smyrna, especially under Diocletian, from B.C. 303 to 313, Christians were bitterly persecuted. As we can see in Revelation 2, verse 10, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried, and shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. But gradually, pagan Rome was losing its ability to control the masses with their pagan religions. Because it was generally known amongst those who were educated, those who were highly educated, that the pagan gods were simply a superstitious means to keep the ignorant under control. And they knew this. It's totally different with the Jews. The more educated the Jews were, the more they could see the verity and reality and authenticity of what God was telling them, that this was the right thing. The more they learned, the more they realized it's the right thing. The more the Romans learned, the more they realized their religion was ridiculous. Well, Constantine realized he needed something different. So in 313, Constantine arranges for the Edict of Milan so that Christians would no longer be persecuted for their faith. And in 324, Christianity became the religion of the empire. Paganism was still permitted, but Christianity, or so-called Christianity, is still the religion of the empire. Well, Constantine wanted to get a control of this because there are too many different ideas. So in 325, we have the Council of Nice. Orthodoxy comes into play. And we can see the third stage of the church had begun, and it's starting to sweep through. Earthly elevation. The apostate church was now gaining favor. It turns out that Constantine not only wanted a uniformity of religion, but he also wanted, it seems, if you read Will Durant, that he also wanted the underground intelligence network that the Christians had. They had to have this. They were in this persecuted minority. They had to have a way to communicate where the empire wouldn't really know about it. So Constantine wanted access to this underground network as well as... So this was for political things. He was not a Christian. He was a Christianized pagan. Well, as the apostate church was gaining favor, we can see that by 533, Justinian, he recognizes the bishop of Rome as Pontifex Maximus, and he sought the unity of the faith, and it had to be the Orthodox faith. They realized it has to be the Orthodox Nicene faith. We've got the creeds, we've got the Trinity, we got this, we got that. We've already decided what your religion's going to be. That's going to be it. Well, with the recognition of the Pope and the Holy Roman Empire in 800, Christianity became not only the majority religion, but the only official religion, and Christians now went from the so-called Christians, now went from being the persecuted minority to now being the persecuting majority. Sacrificing for the sake of Christ, in their mind, has now stopped. Because after all, how can you, when all the world is Christian, how can you sacrifice for Christ? It had stopped. At least for these politically correct Catholic Christians with their empire religion. Nicene Christianity was no longer a choice or a decision. It was an obligation from birth to death. Infant baptism was a way for the parents to demonstrate the fidelity to the empire. It could be done only by priests sanctioned by the empire, and failure to do this for your children was considered a treasonous rebellion. You're not having your kids baptized by the priest. This is the God that's guiding and directing the empire. You're not having your kid baptized by this guy. This is a treasonous act. Are you against the empire? Are you against the king? Are you against the emperor? That's how it was seen. The religious rights, because this was for absolutely everybody, the religious rights were reduced to the absolute lowest common denominator, to the point where there was no need for faith, for piety, for understanding. It was merely a matter of going through the motions. Basically, brethren, it was like branding cattle. Like branding cattle. The prime example of this is the Lord's Supper. We observed that this spring. Here's the greatest privilege we have to do in any ceremony, in anything we actually do. This is something for which we have the most reverence. We study for weeks or months to prepare for this. We do this every year, our entire life long. But what it had come down to was, here's basically it. A fee is paid, the priest, and only the priest, can say the magic words to create and perform the sacrifice. The recipient then eats the wafer and automatically receives the blessing from this procedure. Note there's no need for faith, for piety, for righteousness, or even to understand the words the priest is saying. It could be in a dead language you don't even understand. And this is designed to be done how often? Daily. This is a daily, just like eating. Just like eating. Note that Jesus had spoke these words in Matthew 26:26. Take, eat, this is my body. This implies a decision. You have to take it. People do that in the Mass? No, they sit there. They open their mouth. And there's no decision on the part of the recipient. This wording was eliminated from the Mass. No decisions. It's obligatory. By going to the Mass, the people endorse the clergy and the emperor by acknowledging the God which guided and guided the emperor and gave him his divine right. That's what had happened. Absence from the Mass showed lack of support, and having a different religion was considered as treason. As treason. The Mass is known as a sacrament in the Catholic Church. I think we're all aware of that. Well, if you remember the word mysterion, the Greek word mysterion was this meat sacrificed to idols, this mysterious thing. You go through these motions, you automatically get this blessing. Well, it turns out if you look at the Latin translation of mysterium, mysterion, it's sacramentum. This is the exact duplication of the meat sacrificed to idols is now the sacrament of the Mass. Both were mindless procedures which showed support for a monolithic society, unified and unquestioned religious and civil authority altogether, completely inseparable. Well, God had said in Amos 8:11, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread or a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord." This was the 1260 days. The true church, this woman in the wilderness, outside of this, she can look in. She can see what was happening. She wasn't in that city, Babylon. She was out. She saw the corruption of Christianity, the elimination of Christian principles, the eradication of true sacrifice. And finally, she used her only option left, which is to flee into the wilderness. You got to get out of the city. The city was Babylon. This is also shown in the life of Elijah. If we look at 1 Kings 16:30-31, Ahab, he takes a wife, Jezebel. He went and served Baal and worshipped him. And with this, the true church pictured Elijah, who was fleeing into the wilderness. 1 Kings 17:1, "And Elijah said unto Abraham, As the Lord God of Israel liveth, there shall not be dew or rain these years, but according to my word." God tells Elijah in 1 Kings 17:3-4, "Get thee hence, turn eastward, hide thyself by the brook Cherith." Cherith means covenant. "That is before Jordan. And it shall be that thou shalt drink of the brook, and I will have commanded the ravens to feed thee." Well, ravens were considered as unclean birds. Well, certainly what the woman, the true church in the wilderness, was being fed by was considered as unclean by the empire church. But where they were being fed is what God wanted for their nourishment. They were seen as unclean birds by the majority, but this is exactly what God wanted for them. Well, when the brook Cherith dries up, Elijah is told to go to the widow in Zarephath, which means Zarephath means refinement. There's a wonderful chart on the second volume, page 256, showing Elijah in the wilderness for these 3.5 years. Well, religion had been degraded to this lowest common denominator for pagan Rome and for papal Rome. But it had to be. It had to be to achieve their purposes, because for universal application to fallen, ignorant men who had no interest in religion, you had to dumb it down to something they just did. Just tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to think or believe. I don't care about that. Tell me what I have to do. That's it. In fact, in the Man of Sin chapter, Brother Russell says, "All who profess Christ were expected to conform to the usages and regulations of the gradually self-exalting hierarchy. Error, always more popular than truth, when exalted to influence and power, hunted down, proscribed, and made disreputable the truth in a hall and all who held it." The true church woman fled into the wilderness, into solace, into solitude, an outcast because of her fidelity to the truth and to the true Lord and head of the church. We could also trace the four periods of the rise of papacy from the man of sin, organized into hierarchy. The popes begin to exercise civil authority in 539. Finally, we have in 800, we have the Holy Roman Empire. So this rise. Well, as the papal power grew, the true Christians became their targets. They threatened the very fabric of society, after all. Here's a different religion. They didn't recognize the priests. Although the true Christians were making purely religious decisions of faith and fidelity to God, these were interpreted as treason by the state. Well, this included the Arians, the Donatists, Albigenses, Waldenses, Anabaptists, Catharers, Huguenots, and the list goes on and on. Many others from all over Europe. They simply wanted the liberty to make honest decisions about how to properly follow Christ. They were called heretics. The word heretic comes from the Greek herein. Sounds a lot like whorine, doesn't it? dear Brother Don here. Greek herein, which simply means to exercise an option in the presence of alternatives. So if you're a heretic, you'd like to make a choice. Jesus had said in John 15:19, if you were of the world would love its own. Because you are not of the world will hate you. You are not of the world. Well, what was happening is the heretics could see that the world was no longer something around the church. It was something that had become identical with the church. In other words, it was just society. Society was declared that it was Christian, regardless of their actions, piety, belief, anything. The standard of Christian behavior and the standard of ordinary human base behavior had become identical. This was so that the true Christians, this was so true that true Christians who spoke and lived a righteous life of piety and Christian conduct, they became suspect. And this is a quote from actually a court proceeding. It says, when certain people were being investigated for suspected Anabaptist leanings, this testimony was offered. Because their children are being so carefully and devoutly reared, and because they do not have the practice of cursing and swearing, therefore they are suspected of being Anabaptists. They're against the empire. They're so good, they're so Christ-like, they can't be Christians. That's really what they're saying. Conversely, we can read of people being cleared of Anabaptist leanings because of their bad deportment. In other words, if they would, you know, sleep around or swear or cause fights or stink or whatnot, get drunk, you're one of us. You're great. You're a good Christian. You're a good Catholic. So, you know, things have been turned around. Also, what you might say, what truths did they have? Well, Waldenses, and Waldenses actually goes back centuries and centuries before Waldo. The word Waldense really means it's a derivation of the word valley. If you look at valley in different languages, really the Waldenses were those who lived in the valleys, the Piedmont, and other areas of mountainous areas or valley areas which are not as accessible. Which is very interesting. But what did they believe? Well, they realized that transubstantiation was false. They knew that the Pope and the King are not the head of the church. Mary's not the mother of God. In fact, this is well known in 1025. There's a fellow named Berengarius who realized the Lord's Supper is not the actual body and blood of Christ. It's a symbol. They also realized the sacraments in the Holy Church there's no one who can attain salvation through the sacraments, because the sacraments are just things mechanically you do. Open your mouth, plop. I guess I'm saved now. No, if you're thinking, you say, this is crazy. This is ridiculous. It was well understood that the idea of transubstantiation could be believed only by the superstitious and ignorance, because after all, when Jesus, you know, if Jesus has, if this hymnal were the unleavened bread, and he's holding it up, that night of the 14th says, this is my body broken for you. And somebody could say, whoa, Jesus, hold on. No, this is your body here. This is a piece of bread. Well, of course it's a symbol. Anybody who would just put them back in what was actually happening, they say, this is a symbol. He's not being literal. If you're going to take it literally, you're missing the whole point. They knew this. These were thinking people. They had the scriptures or certainly important fragments of them. Because Jesus' literal body was still holding the bread. They knew this. They knew the idea of Christendom, Christ's kingdom, was a complete falsehood. The true Christians became known as defenseless Christians because they didn't fight back when persecuted. They were known as harmless as doves. They were really the conscientious objectors of their day. By the time we get to Waldo in the Thyatira period of the church around the middle 1100s, the Holy Roman Empire is now in full control. The heyday of the Catholic Church is what the rest of the world calls the Dark Ages. The Latin is now the mysterious dead language understood only by the priests when they do the Mass. Now let's note what's said to the Church of Thyatira during this period. And unto the angel of the Church of Thyatira write, I know thy works, charity, service, faith, patience. Notwithstanding, in Revelation 2:20, I have a few things against thee, because thou sufferest that woman Jezebel, calls herself a prophetess, to teach, seduce my servants, to commit fornication, and to eat things sacrificed to idols. Now, how can that be? Pagan sacrifices to idols have been gone for 700 or 800 years. What's being talked about? This is the Mass. Because the sacramentum and the mysterion were exactly the same thing. They were going through the motions and doing something no more efficacious to salvation than meat being sacrificed to idols. The most sacred thing a Christian has the opportunity to do had been dumbed down to a meaningless, mindless ceremony. But the adversary had made a perfect copy of it through this Mass. Well, progress was made in doctrine and with the work of Wycliffe and Luther, but it really seems that these did not acknowledge the terrible. Error of church union with civil rulers. They both continued the idea of Christian society rather than Christian minority. As we would say, the sacrificing little flock. They thought Christianity was supposed to be the entire society. During the work of these reformers, the Waldenses and the Anabaptists and others continued to be persecuted and killed, even in the areas of the Reformation. But the doctrines of the true Christians were powerful, especially as the Reformation continued and Europeans began to read and think for themselves. In fact, while the Anabaptists were being burned at the stake, one of the problems they had is they'd get them up on the stake and it takes a while for the flames to rise up and kill them. So while they're there for 15 minutes, they are witnessing. They're tied to the stake, they're witnessing. And what happens is they kill one Anabaptist and over the next 10 or 15 minutes, they've created a dozen more because the ideas, the doctrines, the ideology, the theology, the scriptures they're sharing are so powerful. It's converting others. It's opening their eyes. The weakness of the Catholic Church can be shown by the fact they would never wanted to debate the heretics because the Catholic Church ideology was so weak and so devoid of life that anything that made sense, which only the heretics could say, they didn't want this heretic. They don't want to go head to head with the heretics. Well, the work of Martin Luther was a very good work in God's plan, but it was too soon for the call to come out of for my people. They were still going to have this church-state union. They were still going to be blended together. The doctrine of justification by faith that Luther was promulgating actually backfired to a large extent. And this is the reason for that, is before Luther, it was justification by good works. Well, if you're going to avoid going to hell and you don't have any money, what's your only choice? You've got to do good works, right? Well, then you learn justification by faith, and you can say, well, I believe in Jesus. Great. I don't have to be good anymore. Keep in mind, lowest common denominator. What would the common man want to do? Oh, I don't want to go to hell. Great, I believe in Jesus. One less thing. So good works were downgraded, and now you can see the moral climate of Northern Europe actually decreased as a result. Not amongst the true Christians. Not amongst those in the wilderness. But those who are in the city, the morality of the city, down lower. The reformers may have seen the Antichrist, but they didn't see the great whore. They still thought that God had intended a Christian society, both then and there. Well, those in the wilderness knew that the followers of Christ must always be the minority, or else their true relationship to Christ would cease. Well, finally, with the work of Napoleon, the world began to change. This was really a civil revolution to show the Pope had no power. Bible societies sprang up. Persecution stops. And I appreciate Song of Solomon 8:5. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? Up from the wilderness. They relied on the word of God as the example of Jesus during those 1260 long years of faithfulness and persecution. Well, the Enlightenment continued with the work of the Miller movement, the work of the Seventh Messenger. Now, note that Brother Russell was not a minister in any established church. He was still in this wilderness condition. Not like the 1260 years. That was gone forever. But still in the wilderness. He wasn't in the city. He wasn't a part of some huge nominal church. World-pleasing church. He saw and understood this wilderness condition and the great horror even though the 1260 years were now over. In Daniel 12:7, and I heard a man clothed with linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and sware by him that liveth forever, that it shall be a time, times, and a half. I know who that man is, and you do too. Well, the return Lord through Brother Russell helped me see this. Revelation 17:1, and there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials. He talked with me. He said, come hither, I will show thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit, in my mind, in the influence, so I could go back in history, see what was happening. He took me into the wilderness, not literally back into, I mean, there's no time machine to go back into the 1260 years, but in our minds we can, through history and what Brother Russell is telling us, we can learn what this was. We can see this mother of harlots, the abominations of the earth, this one riding on the scarlet-colored beast. We have this privilege to be carried away in our minds, to have this understanding. Now, we are still in the wilderness, but nothing like the 1260 years. We, like Abraham, look for the city whose builder and maker is God. We're looking for the New Jerusalem. Here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. We're thankful that so many of our faithful brethren, and many, many, many more than I first thought, were willing to be heretics, to make a decision, to choose the right way, and to live their faith even when it meant a death sentence. Brethren, may we all continue to be heretics and continue to evaluate, to decide, and to choose, and to make the truth our own. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Harry. An impetus to our faith, is it not, to remember not only our brethren, but also who gives the victory? And that same God gives us the victory in Christ Jesus, if so be that we look to him. Now, brethren, we had promised that we would give you some additional announcements. There's a comfort letter in the vestibule out there that once you sign it, we'll copy it and send it to the list of brethren that you are providing for us. So there's one list where you put brethren that might need this letter of comfort, and then there's the letter of comfort that, of course, is an opportunity for those, every one of us, to open our hearts to our brethren, to testify and to encourage. There's also a thank you note to the kitchen crew that's on the same table. Also, for your creature comfort, cushions in the hall. And the MP3 recordings, the little discs, will be available. Those will be for free. And contact Sister Millie or our class secretary, or there's a sign-up sheet on the table. Again, for the MP3s and the comfort letters, it really is quite helpful if you can provide addresses. There's a sign-up sheet in the back of the room, the hall here, for table service if you'd like to help with those Martha-like duties. And we also would request, especially for those of you that have chosen to sit not in the first two rows of tables, but all the rows after that, to remove your belongings to make way for the meals at when meal times come. And we also have this piece of news for those that haven't heard. We will mention to you that, again, we sorrow not of, as others who have no hope, but Sister Becky, Becky Rebecca Millen Hess has gone to her reward. And, of course, we know we can especially remember Brother Millen, Brother Leon, during this time of his double loss this year of both Sister Barbara, his wife, and now one of his dear daughters. And with that, let us close this service with a singing of hymn 47.